Our final speaker is a distinguished fellow at the Mises Institute. He is not only that, he has received the highest honor that the Institute bestowed, and that is the Gary Schlarbaum Prize. He's a professor emeritus in economics at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, the founder and president of the Property and Freedom Society that meets every year in Bodrum, Turkey. He's the author of a number of books, Economic Science and the Austrian Method, Theory of Socialism and Capitalism, The Defense of Private Property, Democracy, The God That Failed. But of course, he's accomplished all these things all the while he was on my thesis committee and recently my best man. So there's no question that is the only gentleman who could be our final speaker today, because he's a very important man in my life. He's going to be talking about why Mises and not Hayek, and on politics, money and banking, two speeches in one. Please help me welcome Hans Hermann Hoppe.
As Doug announced, I indeed have two speeches in one. They are not closely connected, but I felt the need to briefly address the Mises-Hayek question and then continue with a more substantial speech on politics, money, and banking. Let me begin with why Mises and not Hayek. And to begin this subject, I'll start with a quote from an article that my old friend Ralph Reichel wrote some 15 years ago. And in this article, Reichel said, "Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek are widely considered the most eminent classical liberal thinkers of this century. They are also the two best-known Austrian economists. They were great scholars and great men. I was lucky to have them both as my teachers. Yet it is clear that the world treats them very differently. Mises was denied the Nobel Prize of Economics, which Hayek won the year after Mises' death. Hayek is occasionally anthologized and read in college courses when a spokesman for free enterprise absolutely cannot be avoided. Mises is virtually unknown in American academia. Even among organizations that support the free market in a general way, it is Hayek who is honored and invoked, while Mises is ignored or pushed into the background. Now, I want to speculate and I want to present a thesis why this is so, and I want to explain why I, and I take it most of us here, take a very different view. Why I, and presumably you, are Misesians and not Hayekians. My thesis is that Hayek's greater prominence has little, if anything, to do with his economics. There is, in fact, little difference in Mises' and Hayek's economics. Indeed, most economic ideas associated with Hayek were originated by Mises, and this fact alone would make Mises rank obviously far above Hayek as an economist. But most of today's professed Hayekians are not trained economists. Few have actually read the books that are responsible for Hayek's initial fame as an economist, that is, his monetary theory and the trade cycle, and his prices and production. And I venture the guess that there exist no more than 10 people alive today who have studied from cover to cover Hayek's pure theory of capital. Rather, what explains Hayek's greater prominence is Hayek's work mostly in the second half of his professional life in the field of political philosophy and political theory. And here, in this field, the difference between Hayek and Mises is striking indeed. My thesis is essentially the same that was also advanced by my friend Ralph Raiko. Hayek is not a classical liberal at all, or a radikal liberaler, as the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, the best newspaper in Switzerland, recently referred to him, as usually completely clueless. Hayek is actually a moderate social democrat. And since we live in the age of social democracy, this makes him a respectable and responsible scholar. Hayek, as you may recall, dedicated his road to serfdom to the socialists in all parties. And the socialists in all parties now repay him by using Hayek to present themselves as liberals. Now to the proof, and I rely for this mostly on Hayek's Constitution of Liberty and his three-volume Law, Legislation, and Liberty, which are generally regarded as Hayek's most important contributions to the field of political theory. What follows now are mostly quotes from these works, interspersed with brief comments. According to Hayek, government is necessary to fulfill the following tasks, not merely for law enforcement and defense against external enemies, but in an advanced society, government ought to use its power of raising funds by taxation to provide a number of services which for various reasons cannot be provided or cannot be provided adequately by the market. Comment, since at all times an infinite number of goods and services exist which the market does not provide, Hayek hands government here some sort of blank check. Among these are protection against violence, epidemics, or such natural forces as floods and avalanches, but also many of the amenities which make life in modern cities tolerable. Most roads, the provision of standards of measure, and of many kinds of information ranging from land registers, maps, statistics, to the certification of the quality of some goods or services offered in the market. Additional government functions are the assurance of a certain minimum income for everyone. Government should distribute its expenditures over time in such a manner that it will step in when private investment flags. It should finance schools and research, as well as enforce building regulations, pure food laws, the certification of certain professions, the restrictions on the sale of certain dangerous goods such as arms, explosives, poisons, and drugs, as well as some safety and health regulations for the processes of production and the provision of such public institutions as theaters, sports grounds, and so forth. And it should make use of the power of eminent domain to enhance the public good. Moreover, it generally holds, again, quote, there is some reason to believe that with the increase in general wealth and of the density of population, the share of all needs that can be satisfied only by collective action will continue to grow. Further, government should implement an extensive system of compulsory insurance, allegedly for the reason for coercion intended to forestall greater coercion. Public subsidized housing is a possible government task, and likewise city planning and zoning are considered appropriate government functions, provided that the sum of the gains exceed the sum of the losses. And lastly, the provision of amenities of or opportunities for recreation or the preservation of natural beauty or of historical sites or scientific interest, natural parks, nature reservations, and so forth are legitimate government tasks. In addition, Hayek insists that we recognize that it is irrelevant how big government is or if and how fast it grows. What alone is important for Hayek is that government actions fulfill certain formal requirements. It is the character rather than the volume of government activity that is important. Taxes as such and the absolute height of taxation are not a problem for Hayek. Taxes and likewise compulsory military service lose their character as coercive measures if they are at least predictable and are enforced irrespective of how the individual would otherwise employ his energies. This deprives them largely of the evil nature of coercion. If the known necessity of paying a certain amount of taxes becomes the basis of all my plans, if a period of military service is a foreseeable part of my life, then I can follow a general plan of my life of my own, making and am as independent of the will of another person as men have learned to be in society. End of quote. My comment, but please, it must be a proportional tax and a general military service. Now, I could go on and on, citing Hayek's muddled and contradictory definitions of freedom and coercion, but that shall suffice to make my point. I am simply asking, what socialist and what green would have any difficulties with all of this? Following Hayek, they all can call themselves proudly liberals today. Now, in distinct contrast, how refreshingly clear and very different is Mises. For him, the definition of liberalism can be condensed in a single word, namely private property. The state, for Mises, is legalized force, and its only function is to defend life and property by beating antisocial elements into submission. As for the rest, government is, I quote, the employment of armed men, of policemen, gendarmes, soldiers, prison guards, and hangmen. The essential feature of government is the enforcement of its decrees by beating, killing, and imprisonment. Those who are asking for more government interference are asking ultimately for more compulsion and less freedom. End of quote. Moreover, and this is for those who always pipe up, but Mises was no anarchist. Mises allows for unlimited secession down to the level of the individual if one comes to the conclusion that government is not doing what it is supposed to do, namely to protect life and property. And Mises, through his entire life, never repudiated the statement about everybody has the right of unlimited secession. Mises then, as my own intellectual master Murray Rothbard has noted repeatedly, is an extremist. He is a laissez-faire radical. And Hayek, in my view, is a muddlehead, and I personally like extremists, and I do not like muddleheads all that much. So now to the second speech, which is only very indirectly related to the first part, only insofar as what I now want to do is an analysis in the style of Mises and Hayek, of Mises and Rothbard. I'm sorry. My head is slightly muddled already also. So imagine that you are in command of the state apparatus. And the state is defined as an institution that possesses, on the one hand, a territorial monopoly of ultimate decision-making in every case of conflict, including conflicts involving the state and the operators of the state itself. And second part of the definition, the state is then by implication an institution that has the right to tax, that is, to unilaterally determine the price that the state's subjects must pay to the state to perform this task of ultimate decision-making. Now, to act under these constraints, or rather under this lack of any constraints, is what constitutes politics and political action. And it should be clear from the outset that politics, then, by its very nature, always means mischief. Not from your point of view. Remember, you are in charge of the state. You run the state. Not from your point of view, of course, but mischief from the point of view of those that are subject to your rule as the ultimate judge in every case of conflict. Predictably, you will use your position to enrich yourself at other people's expense. More specifically, we can predict in particular what your attitude and policy vis-a-vis money and banking will be. Assume that you rule over a territory that has developed beyond the stage of a primitive barter economy, and where there is a common medium of exchange that is a money in existence. First off, it is easy to see why you would be particularly interested in money and monetary affairs. As a state ruler, you can in principle confiscate whatever you want and provide yourself with an unearned income. But rather than confiscating various producer or consumer goods, you will naturally prefer to confiscate money, because money, as the most easily and widely saleable and acceptable good of all goods, allows you then the greatest freedom to spend your income as you happen to like it, on the greatest variety of goods. First and foremost, then, the taxes you impose on society will be money taxes, whether on property or on income. And you will want to maximize your money tax revenue. Now, in this attempt, however, you will quickly encounter some rather intractable difficulties. Eventually, your attempts to further increase your tax income will encounter resistance in that higher tax rates will not lead to higher but to lower tax revenue that you collect. Your income, that is, your spending money, declines because producers burdened with increasingly higher tax rates simply produce less. In this situation, you only have one other option to further increase or at least maintain your current level of spending, namely by borrowing funds. And for that, you must go to banks. And hence, your special interest also in banks and the banking industry. If you borrow money from banks, these banks will automatically take an active interest in your own future well-being. That is, they will want you to stay in business, and that is to say, they want the state to go on in its exploitation business. And since banks tend to be major players in society, such support is certainly beneficial to you. On the other hand, as a negative, if you borrow money from banks, you are not only expected to pay back your loan, but you are also expected to pay interest on top. The question then that arises for you as a state ruler is this. How can I free myself of these two constraints? First, of the constraint of tax resistance in the form of lower or falling tax revenue, and the second constraint of the need to borrow from and pay interest to banks. Now, I suggest that it is not too difficult to see what the ultimate solution to your problem, the problem of the state, is. You can reach the desired independence of taxpayers and tax payments and of banks if only you establish yourself first as a territorial monopolist of the production of money by saying, on my territory, only I am permitted to produce money. But that is not sufficient, because as long as money is a regular good that must be expensively produced, there is nothing in it for you except expenses. More importantly is then that you must use your monopoly position in order to lower the production cost and the quality of money as close as possible to zero. Instead of costly quality money such as gold or silver, you must see to it that worthless pieces of paper that can be produced practically at zero cost will become money. In parentheses, normally, of course, no one would accept, you have heard that repeatedly, no one would, of course, accept worthless pieces of paper as payment for anything. Pieces of paper are acceptable as payments only insofar as they are, and that's what they initially were, as they are titles to something else, namely they function as property titles. In other words, then, you must replace pieces of paper that were titles to real money with pieces of paper that are titles to absolutely nothing. Now, under competitive conditions, if everyone could produce this type of paper money, a money that can be produced at almost zero cost would be produced up to a quantity where marginal revenue equals marginal cost. And since marginal cost is zero, the marginal revenue, that is, the purchasing power of money, would be zero as well. Hence, the necessity to monopolize the production of paper money so as to restrict its supply in order to avoid hyperinflationary conditions and the disappearance of money from the market altogether, and the flight into real values. And the necessity to monopolize this is, of course, the greater, the cheaper, the lower quality money we have in front of us. In a way, you have thus accomplished what all alchemists and their sponsors wanted to achieve. You have produced something valuable, something with purchasing power, out of something that is practically worthless. What an achievement this is. It costs you practically nothing, and you can turn around and buy yourself something really valuable, such as a house or a Mercedes or a BMW, and you can achieve these wonders not just for yourself, but also for your friends and acquaintances, of which you discover that you have far more than you had known before, including, of course, many economists who explain why your monopoly is really good for everyone. Now, what are the effects of this? First and foremost, more paper money does not in the slightest affect the quantity or quality of all other non-monetary goods in existence. There exist just as many other goods around as before. Now, this immediately refutes the notion that is apparently held by most, if not all, contemporary mainstream economists, namely that more money can somehow increase social wealth. To believe this, as everyone proposing so-called easy money policies as efficient ways and socially responsible ways out of economic troubles apparently does, is to believe in magic, namely that stones or rather paper can be turned into bread. Again, let me emphasize that I have the impression that there are practically no economists around nowadays who dispute that almost all economists nowadays tend to believe in this magic, that more paper can heal economic crisis. They have not grown beyond the age of kindergarten children. Even they might see through this. Rather, what the additional money you printed will affect is twofold. On the one hand, money prices will be higher than they would be otherwise, and the purchasing power per unit of money will be lower. Or in a word, the result will be inflation. More importantly, however, all the while, the greater amount of money does not increase the total amount of presently existing social wealth, that is, the total quantity of all goods in society. It redistributes the existing wealth in favor of you and your friends and acquaintances, that is, those who get your money first. You and your friends are relatively enriched. You own a larger part of social wealth now, at the expense of impoverishing others, those who own less, and those other people who receive the money, the newly created money, later or last. The problem for you and your friends with this institutional setup is not that it doesn't work. It works perfectly, always to your own and your friends' advantage, and always at the expense of others. All you have to do is to avoid hyperinflation. For in that case, of course, people would avoid using money altogether and flee into real values, and thereby you would be robbed of your magic wand that you control. The problem with your paper money monopoly, if there is one at all, is only that this fact will be immediately noticed also by others and recognized as a big criminal rip-off that it indeed is. But this problem can be overcome too. If, in addition to monopolizing the production of money, you also set yourself up as a banker and enter the banking business with the establishment of a central bank. Because you can create paper money out of thin air, you can also create credit out of thin air. In fact, because you can create credit out of nothing, that is, without any savings on your part, you can offer loans at cheaper rates than anyone else, even at interest rates as low as zero. With this ability, not only is your former dependency on banks and the banking industry eliminated. Moreover, you can make banks dependent on you, and you can forge a permanent alliance and complicity between banks and state. You don't even have to become involved in the business of investing the credit yourself. That task and the risk involved in it, you can safely leave to the commercial banks. What you, your central bank, need to do is only this. You create credit out of thin air and then loan this money at below market interest rates to commercial banks. Instead of you paying interest to banks, banks now pay interest to you. And the banks, in turn, loan out your newly created easy credit to their business friends at somewhat higher but still at sub-market interest rates to earn from the interest differential. In addition, to make the banks especially keen on working with you, you may permit the banks to create a certain amount of their own new credit, of new checkbook money, in addition and on top of the credit that you have created out of thin air. This is the fractional reserve banking system that we have to live with. Now, what are the consequences of this monetary policy? To a large extent, they are the same as with an easy money policy. First, an easy credit policy is also inflationary. More money is brought into circulation, and prices will be higher, and the purchasing power of money will be lower than would be the case otherwise. And second, the credit expansion too has no effect on the quantity or quality of all goods currently in existence. It neither increases nor decreases their amount. More money is just this, more paper. It does not and cannot increase social wealth by one iota. And third, easy credit also engenders a systematic redistribution of social wealth in favor of you, namely the central bank, and the commercial banks within your banking cartel. You receive an interest return on money that you have created at practically zero cost out of thin air, instead of on money that you had to costly save first. And so do the banks, who earn additional interest on your costless money loans. Both you and your banker friends thereby appropriate an unearned income. You and the banks are enriched at the expense of all real money savers, those who receive a lower interest return than they otherwise would have received, that is, without the injection of your and the bank's cheap credit into the credit market. On the other hand, there also exists a fundamental difference between an easy print and spend money policy and an easy print and loan credit policy. First off, an easy credit policy alters the production structure, has an effect on what is produced and by whom in a highly significant way. You, that is, the chief of the central bank, can create credit out of thin air. You do not have to first save money out of a given income. That is, you do not have to cut your current expenses and thus abstain from buying certain non-money goods, as every normal person, of course, must if he extends credit to someone else. You only have to turn on the printing press and can thus undercut any interest rate demanded of borrowers by savers elsewhere in the market. Granting credit does not involve any sacrifice on your part, which is why this institution is, of course, so nice. If things then go well, you will be paid a positive interest return on your paper investment. And if they don't go well, as a monopoly producer of money, you can always make up losses more easily than anyone else, namely by covering your losses with even more printed paper. And without costs and no genuine personal risk of losses then, you can grant credit essentially indiscriminately to everyone and for any purpose without concern for the creditworthiness of the debtor was the soundness of his business plan. Because of your easy credit, certain people, in particular investment bankers, who otherwise would not be deemed sufficiently creditworthy, and certain projects, in particular projects of banks and of their main clients, that would not be considered profitable, but wasteful or too risky, instead they do get credit and do get funded. Essentially, the same applies to the commercial banks within your banking cartel. Because of their special relationship to you as the first recipients of your costless low-interest paper money credit, the banks too can offer loans to prospective lenders at interest rates below market interest rates. And if things go well for them, they go well. And if they don't, they can rely on you again as a monopolistic producer of money, that you will bail them out in the same way as you would bail out yourself out of any financial trouble, namely buy more paper money. Accordingly, the banks also will be less discriminating in the selection of their clients and their business plans, and more prone to funding the wrong people and the wrong projects. And there's a second significant difference between a print and spend and a print and loan policy. And this difference explains why the income and wealth redistribution in your and your banker friend's favor that is set in motion by easy credit takes the specific form of a temporal boom-bust cycle. That is, of an initial phase of seeming general prosperity, of expected increases in future incomes and wealth, followed by a phase of widespread impoverishment when the prosperity of the boom period is revealed as a widespread illusion. Now, this boom-bust feature is a logical and physically necessary consequence of credit created out of thin air, of credit unbacked by savings, or, as Mises says, of fiduciary credit, and of the fact that every investment takes time and only shows on later in time, at some time in the future, whether it is successful or not. The reason for the business cycle is in a way as elementary as it is fundamental. Imagine Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe can give a loan of fish, which he has not consumed, to Friday. Friday then converts these savings into a fishing net. He can eat the fish while constructing the net. And with the help of the net, then, Friday, in principle, is capable of repaying his loan to Robinson, plus interest, and still, for himself, earn a profit of additional fish for himself. But all of this is physically impossible if Robinson's loan is only a paper note denominated in fish, but unbacked by any real fish savings. That is, if Robinson has no fish because he himself has already consumed it all, then, and necessarily so, Friday must fail in his investment endeavor. Now, in a simple barter economy, of course, this becomes immediately apparent. Friday would simply not accept Robinson's paper credit in the first place, but he would only accept real commodity credit, namely real fish. And because of this, the boom-bust cycle will not get started in a simple, primitive barter economy. But in a complex monetary economy, the fact that credit was created out of thin air is not immediately noticeable. Every credit note looks like any other. And because of this, the notes are accepted by the takers of credit without any problem. This does not change the fundamental fact of reality, however, that nothing can be produced out of nothing. And that investment projects undertaken without any real funding, any funding whatsoever by previous savings, must fail. But it explains why a boom, that is, an increased level of investment accompanied by the expectation of higher future income and wealth, can get started. Friday does accept the note instead of immediately refusing it. And it explains why it then takes a while until the physical reality reasserts itself and reveals such as expectations as illusionary. But what is a little crisis to you? Even if your path to riches is through repeated crises brought about by your paper money regime and central bank policies, from your point of view, that is, from the viewpoint as a head of state and the chief of the central bank, this form of print and loan wealth redistribution in your and your banker's friend's favor, while it is less immediate than that achieved with a simple print and spend policy, is still much to be preferred, because it is far more difficult to see through and recognize for what it actually is. Rather than coming across as a plain fraud and parasite, in pursuing an easy credit policy, you can even pretend that you are engaged in the selfless task of investing in the future. Of course, always for the good of our children, rather than spending on present frivolities. And you can pretend that you are actually healing the economy from economic crisis, rather than being responsible for causing these crises. Now, what a world this is in which we live. And I can only end by saying the Mises Institute is not an institute that is interested in public policy, making proposals to politicians what they should do and what they shouldn't do, and cozying up to those in power. The achievement of the Mises Institute is to enlighten us, to make us understand how the world works, and to give us enjoyment in being able to say, I understand now what is going on in this world. And if this type of enlightenment and this enjoyment in knowledge is something that you appreciate, then I can only ask you to please be generous to the Institute, donate money to the Institute. I'm not on the payroll of the Mises Institute, so I'm not pleading my own case. I'm pleading the case of mankind and its interest in knowledge and the enjoyable experience of knowing something, understanding something, and being able also to laugh about the idiocy of the world that we inhabit. Thank you very much.